Hi, welcome to Pulling the Threads, a podcast dedicated to understanding the story behind our clothes. I'm your host, Jancy Quinn, and this podcast will follow my adventures in learning more about sustainable apparel and exploring how we can all have beautiful things without harm. I'm a reformed fashion addict and overshopper, but also a lifelong sewer, maker, and lover of the outdoors and our environment. A few years ago, I realized that as beautiful as fashion can make you feel, the industry can be pretty ugly for the people who make our clothes and for the planet. I'm now on a mission to learn about what it means to have eco-friendly, mindful, sustainable, or socially conscious apparel, whichever term you prefer. My goal with this podcast is that we'll learn together, share ideas, and talk about the positive changes we can all make. So let's get started and pull the first thread.
The tremendous amount of fabric waste that we would see stocked up in these warehouses or factories of just, you know, leftover from canceled orders, overproduction, year-round supply that they just didn't really have a customer for. But typically this stuff was going to sit there getting dusty and ultimately end up in landfills.
Today, I'm talking with the co-founders of Public Habit, an apparel company that is challenging the traditional apparel production practices and rethinking supply chain and the way we get our clothing. In full transparency myself, I have worked with Sydney and Zahar as a consultant in helping them with brand strategy and brainstorming ideas around sustainable apparel as we are all navigating this space. I'm excited to have them share their journey here today. They are a small but mighty company that is helping to rethink traditional apparel production practices. Let's get started and pull this thread.
I'm Sydney Badger, Badger like the animal, as we just established off camera. I am the co-founder of Public Habit with Zahar. I grew up in the UK to American parents. And so I ended up back in the US for most of my education and then just never went back to England. So I kind of had it's now been, I guess, almost 15 plus years since I've lived in England, but I still kept the accent going strong. I started my career in China because I studied actually Chinese and international relations at university. And have actually spent almost 6 years at this point living in China. My current place where I'm supposed to be residing is Shenzhen, China, which is southern China on the border with Hong Kong. But I am currently in my lovely hometown of Seattle, which is where I met Zahar because of the current situation we're in. Borders are closed in China, so I am in the States indefinitely at the moment.
My name is Zahar Ivanisov. I grew up in Russia. I was born there and I lived there until I was 22. So I still have the accent. I moved to the States at 22 to pursue my MBA with at University of Virginia, Darden School of Business. And when I graduated from there, I moved to Seattle to work for one of the larger e-commerce companies that we all know. It's Amazon. So I did a few different rotations there, moving from, you know, like a vendor manager to in-stock manager in a few different categories. And Sydney and I met in 2013, almost 7 years. She was my vendor manager. I was in-stock manager. We were managing a sexy category that consisted of black and brown old men's shoes.
I love it.
Yeah, and that's kind of how my, journey in the fashion industry started. That was one of the first exposures and, you know, it really helped me to understand better, like, what this industry is about and, you know, how brands, typical, you know, traditional brands manage and navigate it. I left the company at this point more than 3 years ago and started my own e-commerce brand, focusing on home decor. Then about a couple of years ago at this point, Sid and I started working together and we launched Public Habit last year.
Can you tell me what is Public Habit?
Sure. Public Habit is a no inventory fashion platform that connects end consumers with top tier manufacturers all over the world. We have very strict requirements for our suppliers that allows us to simplify the supply chain, remove the middleman, and provide amazing, great value to our consumers. We started with quality, like high premium quality essentials, and made out of cashmere and wool. And we only make what we sell. And that allows us to eliminate a lot of waste from the supply chain.
I want to chat for just a second about the current moment we're in. So we're recording this on April 7th. We're in the middle of, you know, COVID-19, coronavirus. Sydney, you live in China, and a lot of your production all happens there. Can you guys talk to me a little bit about the impact of this on Public Habit?
Sure. So for context, I was in China on early January, back home after the holidays, back home in China after the holidays, left for a week of vacation over Chinese New Year, along with millions of other Chinese people around January 22nd. And it's always typically a 2-week shutdown. Sometimes factories shut down a bit longer than that for Chinese New Year, sometimes a little bit less, but usually retailers kind of know they're going to lose up to a month of interaction or production with their manufacturers. So January 22nd, I leave. I recognize they shut down Wuhan and start confining and locking down people around China on January 23rd, I believe. I quickly realized within the next week that we weren't getting back into China. And we spent the month of January and February in exile around Asia. It was actually a fairly wonderful, romantic time because Southeast Asia, for some reason, had really, really low cases and still a lot of free movement around. But there was just so much uncertainty about what things were going to look like back in China when, as each week passed. We saw, obviously, an extended shutdown of our factories, but ultimately I think they only ended up closing for a month versus the 2 weeks they had intended to. They were back up and running pretty quickly by mid-February, which is incredible. I mean, I think they came back with definitely kind of a fragmented team with people who hadn't been able to travel back to the factories. But compared to the impact in the US and then the new impact that's happening on the supply chain from how much this epidemic and pandemic has grown elsewhere, I think the impact to Chinese manufacturing and their ability to get back up and running was fairly remarkable and pretty amazing how quickly they did that. Now the challenge is they don't have enough business.
And I've been reading a lot just about canceled orders and, you know, workers in Bangladesh and Myanmar being, you know, not allowed to work or not paid, and just kind of some pretty horrible situations happening in the apparel industry. But it seems like you guys are kind of the antidote for this problem to even have, you know, exist. Can you guys talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you think about the value of the business model that we've been able to build, we are trying to shorten that supply chain. So instead of 18 months or 9 months of production and, you know, product development and production, we can have it done within weeks, right? So I have been reading a lot about, you know, other companies canceling orders as well and liquidating the inventory they already made, right? Like, a lot of large retailers produced millions and hundreds of millions of dollars of inventory for March and April and May and like all the other months at this point. And what happened is basically no one is buying. And I wouldn't say anything, right? But we know the demand has, you know, dropped significantly. So all that inventory needs to go somewhere. And if a brand can't figure out a way to move that inventory through discounts, they're going to liquidate it. So at the end of the day, you know, it's going to go to landfills and it's just going to be waste that is produced again by the fashion industry. So what we're trying, I guess, again, like to figure out is how can we scale this supply chain so that, you know, it's not just us, right? Like we would love for other brands to use the suppliers that we have and, you know, build similar models so that they could react just in time and, you know, build more flexible manufacturing capabilities for not only the times like this when there's a lot of uncertainty, but also as they start, you know, getting back to being normal, I guess.
And I would say the one of the issues that we're also hyper aware of right now is this is probably the first time in my memory that there's so much consumer attention to the life of the worker, of this factory worker who all of a sudden is out of work because brand XYZ that like has a store on the corner that you used to go to once a week has canceled all of their orders. I mean, that human element of just how intensive this supply chain is really palpable right now. And that is the risk of this industry by being so flipped in terms of having supply so far ahead of when it could possibly be sold and in front of a customer has a tremendous amount of risk for everyone along that chain. And the people who are paying the price right now are primarily, I know these businesses are suffering, but you've got people who are literally not able to feed their families because they've lost, they're out of work. So that to us is something that we're excited about the ability to contribute a solution to.
We can't really mitigate all the risks, to be fair, right? If there's a, like, you know, in a situation like this right now, we are seeing a decreased demand across the board for pretty much anything other than essential categories.
Yes.
So something like this would definitely have and is having an impact on our business model as well. So in our case, we're still able to mitigate some of the risks in terms of overproduction, but there are certain trends and risks that we can't. I think we view the traditional models where we're, you know, you're buying and committing to something ahead of time is much riskier in this case.
So before we dive in too much to what you guys are doing and kind of challenging in the industry, where does the name come from? How did you guys come up with that?
I'll let Sydney to answer that.
So, I mean, like with any startup, where we are today is most certainly not where we started. We just messed around with a few names, and then I ended up really liking Public Habit because of the dual meaning of habit, as both also being clothing, and then also being this idea of habits and rituals and creating new kinds of habits. And we do think a lot of what we're doing and asking is for people to question and change their habits around how they shop for fashion, and how do we become a bit more habitual, like we think about, you know, the organic food movement. How do we be a bit more habitual about asking those questions about where and how our clothing were made? I would just add that after our years, so my experience prior to Amazon had been in a traditional brand retail setting. So Ralph Lauren, American Eagle, even at PVH Core, which is brands like Izod, Calvin Klein, like old school brands. So I kind of saw the inner workings of traditional retail, and it really hasn't changed in 30 plus years. But then getting to Amazon was really eye-opening to me because this new concept of kind of democratized marketplace was really exciting. All of a sudden, you've got hundreds of thousands of sellers, many of whom are actually the manufacturer of the product, able to directly reach the end customer. The pricing is way better to the end customer. There's way more efficiency in that supply chain between the manufacturer and the end customer. But the problem is, if you're anything like me, the experience of shopping Amazon fashion is pretty horrendous. A ton of just unknown quality. There's a lot of guessing. It seems as though there's a bit of a price to the bottom in terms of quality out there. Yeah. And so that feeling of like, you don't really know what you're going to get. And the kind of that being counterbalanced with like the trust of buying from a known brand, we thought was very interesting. There was kind of a tension there of like, you're paying, so you go into a lovely Vince store and you buy this $75 t-shirt and you're like, I feel really kind of good about this, but I just spent a lot of money. But like, I know it's really nice and I bought it from a pretty store. And then the difference with buying a $7 t-shirt on Amazon that shouldn't probably be that cheap. I don't really know what that's made of. There just seemed like a huge gap in between.
Definitely.
And I think that that's a lot of what kept Sahar and I motivated to figure out a solution like Public Habit. The original concept for Public Habit was really to start testing product on Amazon as a third-party seller. The concept was Amazon is an amazing platform to be able to be a bit more nimble and flexible with product testing without over-investing inventory in brand development, in marketing, and all of these things that D2C brands have to do to get off the ground. And so we just wanted kind of an umbrella brand that was accessible, broad. I think accessible is the biggest word that kept on coming back.
It's really interesting. So you guys met at Amazon. You're both working there. And then how did you make the leap to launching this clothing brand?
We met in 2013 and I left the company at 2016 at this point. So like late 2016. So for me, it was like, I was already working on a different brand when Sydney and I kind of thought about, you know, doing something together. And I think like I always wanted to build a fashion brand. Like, I don't know why, but I always have been fascinated with the fashion industry and brands and how they're able to charge so much money for, you know, little things and, you know, things that you don't even notice, and a lot of marketing and, you know, like you at the end of the day, like we consumers would pay for all of that. And it's one hand, it was fascinating how they're able to get away with it. On the other hand, it was kind of like, why is this so broken? You know, questions. Mm-hmm. I started talking to Sydney about, you know, doing something together and working on a brand. And in our minds, I think, she mentioned we started with a couple of different ideas. We always knew it was going to be a brand, like a clothing brand, a fashion brand. We didn't know what it would look like, but we just wanted to start, you know, something together. And
there's something like intangible about why we both love fashion. Like, I don't know, I don't have a good answer. I didn't grow up with a seamstress for a mother or grandmother like you, Jancy. I fueled the fast fashion movement as a consumer. Mm-hmm. Like
I did as well. I was part of it.
Not me.
Yeah. Okay. You get to wear that badge. I had two older sisters and a mother who all loved to shop. Like, fashion was just part of our kind of DNA, and growing up in big cities and working in big cities like London, New York, Shanghai, I think you're just exposed to fashion and trends, and it's such a part of the culture, and I've always loved it. And I actually feel like moving to Seattle was a bit of a letdown for me because it was so behind compared to these cities. Yes. I'd lived in, and especially within the Amazon environment, not just like the employee culture of what one would wear to work, but also our approach to fashion and trends. It wasn't magic anymore. It wasn't fun. And I did the weird pivot from a Ralph Lauren, highly design-driven company into a very analytics-driven company. And I wanted to be somewhere in between. And I think with Zahar and I always found a lot of energy talking about like fashion ideas and sharing things that we were enjoying. And I think that was part of what sparked this like focus.
You guys both talked about a broken system and this disconnect between, you know, the beauty of fashion and then the reality of like this fast fashion, you know, mega marketplace of Amazon. I've seen the clothes. They're beautiful. You guys have talked about elevated everyday basics, but you're providing them at a really reasonable price. And you guys have really unlocked something in the supply chain. So I'd love to have you guys just talk about, you know, some of the work you've done to fix this broken system.
So it all comes back to a bit of a mindset that I think Zahar and I share, which is that we're pretty frugal and scrappy. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any way we would have gotten into this business without doing a lot of the firsthand research and work that it took to better understand this industry. And that looked like several trips overseas to primarily China, meeting with dozens of factories, understanding their questions, hearing the same kind of pitch over and over again about our MOQ is 1,000 pieces, our MOQ is 2,000 pieces. The negotiation that's part of the...
Sorry to interrupt. Can you tell us what that word is?
MOQ, minimum order quantity. That is the kind of... If you're a small business owner creating product, it's probably like gives you anxiety just thinking about MOQs, because typically they're much higher than one can afford as a small business owner. Who wants to make 2,000 of something that they don't even know if they'll be able to sell? So that experience of meeting them on the ground and then starting to go into the factories and meet with the teams taught us a lot. I'll try and name a few, and I'm sure Zahar, you can layer on, but some of the things that jumped out at us was the tremendous amount of fabric waste that we would see stocked up in these warehouses or factories of just, you know, leftover from canceled orders, overproduction, you know, year-round supply that they just didn't really have a customer for. But typically this stuff was going to sit there getting dusty and ultimately end up in landfills. So we saw this kind of inefficiency with the amount of product that was being made that didn't find the right customer. We also were learning how sophisticated some of these manufacturers were, how much more they knew than us about how to develop and optimize product, deliver it efficiently, make it so that everyone could win, they could make money, customers could get good value. They got the system so much better than us. I mean, they've been doing this in China for some of our factories that we're now working with for over 30 years. And so that expertise really hit home to us, because we're there saying, why are we trying to do their job for them? We should be letting them do what they do best and let us do what we can do best, which is understand the customer in the West that we're trying to cater to, build this platform and this connection point for being able to offer great product and build an audience, but let these factories execute what they do best, design, optimize, develop, and deliver product in a timely fashion. So those are the big things that come to mind. What else would you add, Zahar?
I would say, like, just even thinking about the time when we were working with larger brands, and, you know, it would be like, you know, March, April timeframe, and they would come to you, hey, like, what you need for Q4? And it seemed so normal at that time. Like, yep, sure, here's our projections of what we think we're going to sell. And now, or even like when Sydney and I started working on this, this whole system just doesn't make sense, right? I mean, nobody could predict what's going to sell and how many pairs of a specific shoe we would sell or a specific t-shirt we would sell. The trends change, or, you know, the behavior changes, or there's so many uncertainty and unknown in the whole supply chain and in the customer behavior that it was really difficult to predict. So most of the time, well, I would say like probably like all the time, you're going to be wrong. You either don't have what you need, what customers want, or you have too much of it, right? And then you're trying to figure out how to move that, inventory and try to sell it at a discount through a sale or something. And then you're trying to reorder as much as possible of what's selling, but then you're always late and, you know, you're always getting stuff not on time for the right season. So that whole system just didn't make sense for us. And when we started working Public Habit and visited all the suppliers that Sydney mentioned, we decided that the big part of this solution that we are offering for the industry and for the consumer needs to be a supply chain innovation. We have to bridge this demand and supply in the industry. We have to create a system that would be demand driven. And we did that by partnering with amazing manufacturers that are able to produce just in time. So they are producing on demand. Basically, as we get orders from our customers, we're placing orders with them, and we're able to produce an item within 7 to 10 days. So that basically, thinking about like, you know, 9 months that, you know, all these brands were asking us kind of like to commit to like 9 months in advance, right? And then like 7 to 10 days now, that just seems such a big gap between, you know, where kind of like the industry is and still is and where we see the future.
So I'd love to pause there for a second. You know, it's pretty clear it was a really broken system. And I love some of the things you said. You know, the whole system didn't make sense. You know, Sydney, minimum order quantities. Like this is actually, it sounds like kind of an industry term, but it's a huge problem, you know, creating way more than you potentially need. You're forecasting 9 months out for something that may or may not hit. But it sounds like what you guys have done is challenge this whole system, and you've been able to create a system where you're only producing, in fact, what people order. Is that correct?
That's correct. The potential, you know, the riskiest thing about launching our test, you know, our what we call our soft launch last year, was really trying to determine if customers were going to be willing to wait because of the behavior they've become so accustomed to in the last 15 years. We're asking customers to wait up to 4 weeks for a made-to-order piece from one of our suppliers versus two-day delivery.
That includes delivery, right? That includes the manufacturing time and the time it takes to actually deliver the item from the supplier to end consumer.
So you launched a year ago. So how has that worked for you guys so far? So someone places an order and then they'll get the item 4 weeks later. So how does that work? And then what's the response been?
Yeah, so we actually only went live in October of 2019. So it's very, very new. Yes. We crystallized the concept for what is now Public Habit only close to March of last year. And then it became a quick exercise of really vetting and determining how much supply, how many suppliers do we really need to be able to partner with to get a kind of a something off the ground that's worth testing. And like I mentioned, one of the biggest things that we were looking to test is, will people wait for good value of a high quality product? We are offering, we focused on what we believe China does best, or some of the best in the world, which are cashmere and wool essentials. Mm-hmm. The majority of the cashmere and wool that's produced in the world is all out of China. So from a materials availability, from a knowledge and expertise standpoint, it's all there. We found three exceptional cashmere and wool suppliers, two focused in sweater knits and one focused in outerwear. And once we got them, I think the hardest part was getting was this balance of having a design and production team embedded in a factory with fit and quality control embedded in our team. So we're trying to figure out this balance of letting them drive design and production because they have the resources, they've invested in those capabilities, but making sure it really works for our customer. Because if there's anything that we know, people are still going to react to style, fit above all else.
Yes.
So we were confident we could offer a price that was really meaningful. Our cashmere range starts at $80 and it goes up to about $200. And then our wool outerwear starts at $200 up to $350. So these are suppliers in China who have been producing from many luxury brands from overseas. So we know the quality's there. We know the expertise is there. It was just about getting the fit and the final specs right without over engineering that process, which is what brands do. Like that's why a Max Mara coat is as beautiful as it is, because they've spent 2 years developing it.
Right.
So yeah, that was the first test, and I'd say the reaction in Q4 with a couple of retail tests and partnerships that we did here in Seattle was really, really positive, especially around giving us a confidence that this quality is at the level we believe it is. It is people trading out of a Max Mara coat for one of our coats at a completely different price point. It is trading out of a Vince cashmere sweater into a Public Habit cashmere sweater at the same quality, if not sometimes better. So that's the biggest learning, but we have a long way to go.
So as you guys have dug into this and, you know, you've proven the first test, what are other things that now you also have uncovered that you want to change? Like, what are some other things you wish you could change about, you know, the apparel business or your business in particular?
I think one of the things that we learned as we started working a lot more with manufacturers and trying to understand, you know, the industry and the customer is how much emphasis consumers put on sustainability, and they want to see sustainable products. And one of the challenges is that when we started, we're like, well, what is a sustainable product? Like, what does it mean? You know, right. You know, is it just the materials? Because that seems like this is the only, or, you know, the biggest topic that a lot of brands talk about. You know, they're using recycled materials. They're using organic materials. And once we started educating ourselves on this topic, we realized there's so many aspects of sustainability, and it just the whole supply chain. Basically, if you look at the time and like how the item is designed, is it, you know, a fast fashion item that will go out of fashion in, you know, like 3 months, or is that something mm-hmm. that lasts 4 or 5 years or more, right? How the item is manufactured, like what are the practices at that facility? Who manufactures that item, right? Like the workers, are they being, you know, paid fairly? And how that item is being transported from that point to, you know, distribution center or end consumer. There's so many aspects as you think about this. And we realize that, I mean, there's no way one company or like us specifically in this position can, you know, tackle everything at once. So what we decided that we're going to focus specifically on, you know, like three main things that will differentiate us and that will help make the difference. And as we grow, we will continue to kind of, you know, tackle a lot of other things. So the three things are, we're focusing on timeless designs. So we're producing only something that is not trend driven, something that, you know, people can wear season over season, after season. We are focusing on only producing items that are sold. So we only make what we sell. And the third one, we're only using natural premium materials. So we're currently in wool and cashmere, and we're thinking about other materials that could make sense for us. But, you know, polyester, for example, or other synthetic materials is definitely would be out of question for public habit. We're kind of like trying to figure out, you know, as I said, like other materials that would make sense, but we're trying to be deliberate in where we are, you know, expanding next and what we're using as a company, and, you know, partner with the best manufacturers who can deliver that as well.
I love the focus, and, you know, you're right. I think a lot of companies are just trying a lot of things right now, and some of the things sound sustainable or mindful, but they're not actually making a big impact. So you guys are really doing some incredible things. But it feels like you've really unlocked something here with your production process. How do you guys think you can impact the larger industry?
Very good question. We hope it is big, this impact. You know, we like to think that with any good new idea that requires customer behavior to change, which to an extent ours does, because we're asking customers to wait much longer than they typically have to. I think what you end up seeing is that the industry understands it before the customer understands it. So to that end, we're getting a lot of really positive interest from retailers, licensors, brands, manufacturing agencies, trading aid companies, people who really have been trying to unlock this space of low MOQ, low minimum production, just in time, this idea of being able to be much tighter in the supply chain and much more flexible in the supply chain. And, you know, big companies that, like a Gap, for example, that have grown to the point where it's really, really challenging for them to pivot their supply chain model overnight and to diversify their production, don't have the benefit that we do as a small guy to test all of these different opportunities. So I guess to answer that, I think some opportunities, I think there's lots of opportunities for us to collaborate with larger businesses and brands that are looking to try to test something without having to overturn their supply chain overnight, but want something more flexible to dip their toes in that arena and figure that out. I think that we're a good player that can help showcase the value that you can create there, both not just for the customer, but also for the supplier and the business. You know, we think that this actually is a very sustainable business to be building over time, because we can keep our capital with us. You know, our capital is not out ahead of where we're looking to spend it on, which is typically the biggest risk with most of these retail companies. They've spent many, many, many months ahead of when they maybe need it because they've had to wrap it up in inventory. So I think that that's a very exciting aspect of this from the industry standpoint.
I love it. So you launched 6 months ago and you're now looking at it as a potential, am I correct, like a potential platform or marketplace for other brands?
We're not focused on that yet. That could be an evolution that we're excited about, but what we've really tried to crystallize, and this has really even just been in the last weeks, where we've had more time, I guess, on our hands, is what are we? Are we a marketplace? Are we a brand? What is the difference? And I think the conclusion is that we're a hybrid. We are trying to take the best of what a brand can deliver from a customer standpoint and what a marketplace can deliver from really a supply chain standpoint. And that's our starting point from where we are today and where I think we'll be building in the next few years. So it's the quality, control, trust, and transparency that we think is so important from a brand controlling that conversation, and the shortened supply chain and inefficiencies of a marketplace, of really being able to enable factories to approach us with high quality product and for us to be able to quickly get good product vetted and ready for customers to react to before they commit to it.
I love that. Quality, control, trust, and transparency. That's a great way to look at it. You know, not probably the right things that everyone's always looking at in evaluating the business. If you guys could wave a magic wand like tomorrow, what would you like to change about the industry?
I would say I would love for consumers to demand more from the brands that they buy. I think if we had a more educated consumer as a whole, we would be more educated. You know, we would definitely make better choices. And I think that would help the industry to change faster. You know, so far we've seen, as I mentioned, like we've seen a lot of brands focusing on, you know, materials and fabrics to produce something more sustainably, which is great. But then at the same time, if you're making, you know, leggings made out of recycled materials, but you overproduce them and you have 15,000 units sitting in your warehouse that nobody wants, like that doesn't make any difference, right? Like that just waste that should have been avoided. So I think if we would be able to kind of, as consumers, figure out a way to, you know, get more information and change our habits, I think that would be great. On average, I think we go through 70 or 80 items of clothing a year. So we buy more than one item a week. And that just kind of, again, like doesn't make sense. It's not sustainable, right? Like this stuff comes to your closet and then it goes somewhere. And just our planet is not set up to handle this much clothing. So if we can figure out a way how we can, you know, consume a little bit less, be more educated about what we're buying, So that instead of 70 items, we could buy 50 or maybe 40, maybe 30, maybe we don't buy anything, right? And then we just continue to use what we have. That would put a lot more pressure on the brands to deliver better systems, better quality. All these different marketplaces and brands exist because there is a customer out there. And if it's low quality, it's not produced sustainably and ethically, then that's fine for a lot of people, again, because there's a customer out there. And if that would be different, we would be probably in a different situation.
I actually think about the other side of the equation. I think both are equally important. Customer behavior needs to change, but I don't think it's going to change until brand behavior changes. And I think if there's one thing I could change overnight, it would be how brands and retailers value their business and their impact, because I don't think anything is going to change as long as top line growth is a positive metric or the most important metric to track. Having grown up in retail like Zahar and I have, you were trained to always make that sale, never miss a sale, stack them high, let them fly. It was all about volume. Yep. And we have trained that customer to want 70 to 80 things a year and to give it to them and want it for less. Until these businesses are valued differently and look at value of product over time or repair and reuse or retention or something that's more tied to value over the long term, I don't see how it fundamentally changes.
My last question would just be, you know, I think convenience is probably the cause of a lot of our current problems. And, you know, you guys could have launched a clothing brand a lot easier if you were just trying to make some clothes and sell it in the traditional manner. So I'd love to just know, like, in like the simplest sense, what keeps you both going? What's your guiding light to keep pushing to do things differently?
It just doesn't make sense the way it's happening right now. Like, I think it's just crazy. I mean, you should hear, I sent a video to Zahar when I walked into a don't need to name it store that we're all very familiar with, to the giant sales section at the back of the store.
Yeah.
And it was a hot mess. It was disgusting. And you knew it wasn't going anywhere except for like a great sample sale for the employees and then the bin. And for me, it's if not us, then someone has to do this. So why not us? We're like, we might as well do it.
You know, if you look at the current system, it doesn't make sense. There are a lot of inefficiencies. You know, consumers have been squeezed. They're paying premium for something they don't need to. Brands are overproducing and trying to guess what's going to happen in 18 months. And then retailers are struggling to make a sale because they're just trying to sell, and, you know, continue to move the stuff that, you know, people may not even need in some cases. So we just find the whole system to be very inefficient. And we think we have a solution that, you know, can change this, or at least, you know, make steps in changing it and showing people that it could be done differently. It's not also just about the supply chain and the brands, but it's also on the consumer. I think Sydney mentioned, like, it's on both sides, right? And if we can educate them how to make better decisions, we can provide that solution.
Thanks for tuning in to my latest adventure in understanding the story behind the clothes we wear. I truly believe we can have beautiful things without harm.
To learn more about their mindful and innovative practices and to check out the gorgeous items, visit publichabit.com and follow them on Instagram at publichabit.
If you liked this episode, don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and leave a review. As always, the story continues on our Instagram page at It Matters Wear, WEAR. Give us a follow and join the conversation. Join us next time as we continue our exploration behind the scenes and pull the threads on the stories behind our clothing.